Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of January 22nd, 2025.
Kicking it off this week, first thing I have on deck is an article from Silverfort. It's titled, "If You Think You Blocked NTLM Version 1 in Your Org, Think Again." So Silverfort's research team discovered a new way for attackers to use NTLM V1 in attacks, in any efforts to disable it. This occurs by use of a misconfiguration in on-prem applications that allows attackers to bypass the group policy controls designed to stop NTLM V1 authentication. This NTLM V1 maintains a known weakness with its encryption method and server challenge mechanisms that basically allows for hashes to be intercepted and leveraged to gain unauthorized access to systems. It's kind of been known for quite some time, and most organizations leverage Microsoft's group policy mechanism to stop the use of it. But to leverage this attack that they discovered, all that basically needs to be done is have an on-prem built, and I'm gonna air quote application here, because they could just about be anything, and then set the NTL or the net logon flag for parameter control to 0, which basically means by setting that parameter, you allow NTLM V1 authentication when only NTLM V2 is allowed, and then you have yourself a nice little leverage of NTLM V1. I know most out there are likely thinking NTLM V1 is outdated, no one uses that anymore. I faced similar challenges to this thought process even years ago as an analyst. Interesting statistics, though, that are brought up from Silverfort. 64% of user accounts regularly authenticate with NTLM. So all things considered, this at a minimum is something to be aware of. Microsoft Research did not classify this NTLM V1 bypass report as a vulnerability, but it has begun to take proactive measures by announcing that complete removal of NTLM V1s is starting with Windows 11 version 24H2. And Windows Server 2025, which is awesome. But we also know the reality of the world. Most companies will take time to fully move to systems at that level. So while potentially noisy, depending on your environment, there are some measures from like a hunt and detection side that you can start taking some focus on. So looking at security, successful logon events, this is security event 4624, where the logon type is 3, which is a network logon. And then zeroing in into those logs a little further to look at the NTLM type within that log, which is typically in the detailed authentication information section of the Windows log. So, and specifically what you kind of want to look for is the authentication package being NTLM and the package name being NTLM V1. This can kind of help you look to see if these type of logons are one occurring in your environment, and let you go down that process of figuring out if they should be occurring, if they're going around group policy, if there's something, maybe it's a misconfiguration in your environment you want to fix, or, you know, in the worst case scenario, you might even identify potential use of this attack bypass. So I thought this was interesting, Scott. This rung home again. I love the stuff that rings home to past experiences and see how they're kind of coming back to light. I know you've been in conversations when we talked about past the hash stuff before with NTLM V1, and there's definitely been voices out that have said, oh, well, that can't be leveraged. And it's interesting to see that it's a newfound bypass and something pretty simple. That parameter control isn't overwhelmingly technical or complicated, if I'm saying that the way I'm trying to say it. But yeah, what did you think about this, Scott?
Well, yeah, so I really liked how they laid things out, because it's the article itself presents great graphics and explanations of how NTLM works, and then the different scenarios with the controls in place, and then how the control potentially is bypassed. And, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, a lot of times it's tough to prioritize what you work on from either a security analyst, a threat hunter, a security engineer. And a lot of times what we spend a lot of our efforts on are what's the latest attacks. And we kind of try to ignore where we think we have controls or protections, right? And this is just a great example of, yeah, if you have someone who stands up a server and it's not, and the application isn't configured correctly, they can open up NTLM 1 all of a sudden in your environment, and you wouldn't really know about it unless you're really kind of regularly looking for it. And a lot of times people aren't looking for, when they audit things, the authentication specifically, unless it's like a really, really critical area in the business. Sometimes there's some compliance requirements around it. But you know, it's something that's easy to have visibility to, but you got to look, kind of thing. And so I thought this was a great example of, you know, if you've got cycles, you should kind of have either content that's, you know, exists. And if you don't want to really waste resources and having that kind of content that, you know, you don't expect to get a lot of returns on, I mean, this is where hunting is also, I think, a great solution for some of these things, because you can have, you know, essentially, if you think you have protections and controls in place for this specifically, then you wouldn't expect to get really any results at all back. So it's kind of an easy fire and forget hunt, essentially, where you can kick off some sort of thing that's going to kick back a report later. And if there's anything in it, then it's interesting. And more than likely, it'll take, you know, the 2 seconds to look and say, yep, everything seems normal. Or something can look at it for you and see if there is any entries, kind of thing, depending on how you handle your processes. So I think it's just a great example of, you know, don't forget what you have and be well aware of how your environment's supposed to operate so you can find these things. Because that's kind of how, when they describe discovering this, I like that too, where they're like, hey, we're working with clients with engagements, and they're, you know, they can see that it's configured not to have NTLM-V1, but they're seeing NTLM-V1. And then they started having to do some testing. And when they dug into the flags, they're able to see that's what actually influenced it, which, you know, I thought, you know, was a good find. And it's what a lot of people don't typically do in those cases. So yeah, I thought it was a good way to kind of, like, you know, bring some things to light and, you know, keep in mind some processes that a lot of people probably don't follow up with.
Yeah, this is an interesting one too. That you know, you said it, but this isn't overwhelmingly complicated to go and look in your environment. And I think anybody can kind of homegrown just spin up and look at this. I would imagine most folks are looking at or considering that log, that 4624. Most people are looking at authentication logs, right? And this would be a good one to go look at. So yeah, it's pretty interesting, pretty cool. What do you got next for Scott?
Yeah, so this next one is kind of a notification based on a vulnerability, right? And it was just interesting because it scored pretty high. So it's I picked it up from securityonline.info, but it was just the CVE 2025-0411, and it's 7-zip security vulnerability enables code execution. So I thought this was interesting because it's got a 7.0 as far as a score. It's considered high, but really what the security, or what the vulnerability does, is, if you know, if you're not familiar with what 7-zip is, it's something that you can basically compress files and create archive of your compressed files to move things easier. And when you get things from the internet, download files and things like that, you know, sometimes you'll see the pop-up that'll say, hey, we don't know this source, or this is untrusted. Sometimes it's based off it's signed or not, depending on what you're running. And sometimes it'll just, like, flag as suspicious because it knew you downloaded it from the internet. Well, how your system actually knows that is it gets marked, and they call it mark of the web, right? And mark of the web exists in Windows file systems because they use NTFS. And where that data is actually stored to be marked that way is in what we call an alternate data stream. So it's something that's kind of like attached to the file, but not part of the file. So, you know, what's interesting about that is if you were to move a file that's marked that way to a type of formatting that's not NTFS, it would strip it, right? So it's another way to get rid of it as well, if you don't manually go in and delete it. But essentially, that's what's happening here, is when you make an archive in with 7-zip with the vulnerable version, and you get that vulnerable version archive downloaded or whatever, and then you extract things, the system doesn't, those files don't maintain mark of the web, and so they look like they weren't downloaded from outside, so they're considered more trusted. So that was what was interesting to me, because it didn't seem like they made it sound like, oh, you can use 7-zip to execute code, and it's like, no, not really. It's just one of those things where it's an additional control that's a good one, especially for some standard basic users. But you know, a lot of phishing attacks, for instance, emails, they'll send a 7-zip with a password on it to make it get through all your controls, that's, you know, scanning for things like that. And then when someone tries to get into it and they want to open whatever's in there, usually the mark of the web will also present them with, this might be suspicious too. but it doesn't because of this. So it doesn't, it aids in successful attacks potentially, but it's really about the person than it is the technical part, in my opinion. So like I said, I thought it was interesting that, you know, it was sensationalized the way it was. And I'm sure there's someone out there that probably has some tricky way to maybe utilize this better than how I'm thinking about it. But essentially, that's really what it is, right? It's just a way where you can strip the mark of the web off files because 7-Zip doesn't maintain that in the archive. So, yeah, just kind of like we talked about earlier, it's a basic utility that isn't work exactly as expected.
Yeah, reading this, Scott, you know, the point of the user is going to use it, right? Like the people are going to download, and it's knowing what you're downloading, what you're pulling out, you know, to the best of your knowledge. And even then, you can only go so far. So this does have some relevance to, I think, aiding in some of those, like, the human error part, or the human not being able to see into it, like the code, reading the code kind of thing. The mark of the web piece is important. But, you know, really thinking into this a little bit more, I'm kind of curious, like, how often would that have actually stopped things? It's kind of a stream of thought here. It's thinking back to how many times we've seen in the past where people are, you know, they're pulling SIPs off of a phishing email, they're opening them, they're pulling files out of them, the whole nine, right? So it's kind of thinking about how often that might have actually necessarily prevented that.
That's people go through to actually execute things sometimes.
Yeah.
What point did you not realize this probably wasn't a good thing?
Yeah, and outside of like the... Because, you know, some of the mark of the web, you know, pop-ups would be like, hey, are you sure? And most people are always just blindly clicking, yeah, I'm sure, right? Because they're just trying to get the thing done or get to the thing they're trying to do. I also was thinking, too, when reading through this, like, I wonder what value it would have. Maybe not necessarily for a highly specific hunt, but maybe more of one of those kind of, like, non-structured, like digging in the sea. I wonder if people track how often zip files are being leveraged in their environment. It's a kind of an offshoot thought of this, but it's a thought to put into people's heads. Like maybe there's time, maybe there's, you know, bandwidth or cycles to consider looking at how often are zip files being downloaded, pulled in. You know, can you track any type of any rhythm or pattern in your organization for that? You know, there might be something there to expand on. This is really just a seed thought, but yeah.
Well, what's interesting is I have looked when I was looking at attacks that were leveraging RAR files. So WinRAR essentially, right? For either extracting data or whatever. And I was thinking, well, gosh, like who really uses RAR files anymore? Because I remember using when I was a kid when it kind of came out and about. But then when you kind of look at like the between Zip, 7-Zip, and RAR, like different parts of the world tend to use different compression software. So Europe was primarily RAR, and you know, we're primarily like 7-Zip and Zip here in the United States. So I think there's some value, kind of what you said, like depending on where you're located, you know what file types at least would be more normal. So you kind of be on the lookout for those more, you know, not like more atypical use cases, essentially.
Yeah, that's a good point. So second thing I have this week, we have a blog post from another one, actually. I think we had one last week for this, but a blog post from Sequoia.io. It's called Sneaky 2FA, Exposing a New AITM or Adversary in the Middle Phishing as a Service. So in December 2024, during a daily kind of hunting routine, Sequoia researchers uncovered a new adversary in the middle phishing kit that's targeting Microsoft 365 accounts. These phishing pages have been circulating since at least October 2024 that they found. And during that period, they identified potential compromises through their telemetry. The phishing kit was later identified that it was being sold as a phishing as a service by a cybercrime service called Sneaky Log, which operates through a fully featured bot on Telegram. Customers reportedly receive access to a license that's obfuscated, that has an obfuscated version of the source code, and they deploy it independently. And currently, Sneaky 2FA's phishing pages are hosted on compromised infrastructure, frequently involving WordPress websites. That shouldn't surprise anyone, and other domains controlled by the attacker. So Sneaky 2FA implements a few different characteristics in its service. So it has an auto-grab functionality that it automatically pre-fills the Microsoft phishing page with the victim's email address. Basically, to achieve that, the phishing URL includes the email address as a parameter, either in plain text or encoded in Base64. They launch really convincing fake Microsoft authentication landing pages. They have anti-bot and anti-analysis features like Cloudflare turnstile pages and anti-debugging, HTML and JavaScript obfuscation, traffic filtering. And then they also have a couple little slick things that are just, they're small add-ons to stuff that I've seen in the past, but I think it's interesting because it helps lean to that convincing part of the attack, where they will redirect to Microsoft wiki pages in the event the traffic doesn't meet the expected parameters. So from here, once a victim passes all the checks, the service redirects them to the fake Microsoft auth page that again looks really convincing. It leverages Microsoft's API and then the credentials entered in the 2FA transaction that's passed will then be passed to the attackers to hijack the session. Of note here, though, which is something different than I've seen myself in these kinds of attacks in the past, is that the user is then redirected to a legitimate Microsoft error page. I thought this was pretty smooth. Another interesting note here, the attacker seemingly has a depth of knowledge of Microsoft's impossible traveler rule sets that are like location based, and it also implements hard coded user strings to kind of aid in detection avoidance. So a few little details here that I personally, and maybe you can reference this too, Scott, I personally have seen the adversary in the middle type of attacks where the session hijacks through phishing and capturing people enter credentials into a fake landing page. We've seen this before, but there's a couple little pieces here that I thought were pretty interesting add-ons, as well as the fact that this is being offered as a service and there's code that lets people kind of really pick up and play on this. This one in the past for me when I was an analyst was tricky to identify sometimes because you didn't necessarily have the ability to see this happening outside of like some of the things that are referenced in this article, like the impossible traveler type stuff or the location-based login things. Those would, in most cases, help you identify this kind of thing happening pretty quickly, but they're also relatively, if focused on them, you can get around those detections as they've shown here. So this isn't necessarily meant new as far as the attack type, but the fact that there's this kind of detail and then it's packaged up to just let anybody really plug and play, I thought was worthwhile and worth talking about. Scott, what did you think?
No, like it's interesting because with 2FA being like the push for everybody, there's going to be attacks and approaches to how they want to manage 2FA. And it seems like it's a pretty well thought out solution that they came up with. But the one thing that really stood out to me was they were talking about the user agent strings. And it's something that I think commonly gets overlooked because sometimes it's kind of hard to like, well, what do you do with them kind of thing? But the thing, if people aren't familiar with a user agent is, anytime you talk to a web server or a web service in general, your computer or system or phone, depending on what browser you're using, also offers up a user agent string. And all that basically is saying, hey, this is the type of user I am. These are the versions of the browser I might be using and other things that could be running things from this web server. So when the web server gets it, sometimes it can make decisions on how to present that content to make sure it's compatible with the said browser, said version, or, you know, maybe strip certain things out as well. And like a good example is if you ever looked at a web page on your phone versus your computer, sometimes the web page will look different because it needs the screen's not as big, it presents differently. And user agents are some ways you can manage some of those things. That being said, unless people are switching browsers a lot or switching devices a lot, they should have a pretty consistent user agents. Now, I know as you update, you know, every time you do updates, you can get an updated version of things, which then changes the versioning across everything. So those can change. But they did call out that they had specific user agents that they were almost consistent with every request. They're a little bit atypical. If you look at user agents regularly, then your typical user agents as well. And so, you know, one of the things I always thought was interesting is, you know, from a data perspective, if you have access to user agents, you know, some interesting things you could do with the data in general is, one, just look for rare user agents across your data. There might be some that individually step out, that will be very unique. Like, for instance, if someone's using curl in your environment or connecting to something via a Python, there's definite unique user agents for those, especially. But then if you were to group by user, you might be able to say what users is sorted by the most user agents. And of course, you got to kind of control that time window because updates could be, you know, part of this to, you know, potentially double the score there. But you might be able to suss out where, hey, why does this user have, you know, 13 different user agents when the average user has 6 or 3, depending on how many devices and what they use to, you know, talk and what you can track. So there's interesting things you can do with the data. Like I said, this is a great way when I look at like hunting with data. Might be really hard to build a detection right off of that approach. But from an analysis approach and a hunting, if you kind of know already what you're looking for, you can whittle that down and maybe find some interesting things, you know, as you run this kind of routinely that might, you know, pop out. So that part I thought was really interesting. And they kind of focused on that a little bit as far as, you know, out of all the things they did that were sneaky, the user agent didn't seem that well built as far as the process goes.
Yeah, it's a great point. And then when people look at, dude, this is just an offering from my experience, really consider more of a hunt approach when you're looking at user agent strings versus the detection thing, just because of the volume and the rhythm of it all. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be worthwhile to spend time in that if you haven't considered it.
Yeah.
At least get familiar with it. Know your environment a little more, know what's going on, right?
Right. And like I said, there's some glaring ones that are just be obvious to you, especially if you have a weird problem. Where it's clear it's web traffic not coming from a browser. Those are usually pretty obvious. And then it could be malware or it could be other tools to like download and move things as well. So admins have some interesting traffic as well. But yeah, so it's a good thing to pay attention to.
Now, what do you got last for us this week, Scott?
So his last piece I thought was interesting because, it's kind of cultural, I guess, for the U.S. and especially the time now as we have that kind of change of presidency and stuff. But basically, it was a study that was being done on scams and kind of the social engineering aspect on True Social, right? So True Social is a platform that I believe Trump owns or, you know, is co-owner, supporter, whatever. But the platform is essentially supposed to be a place where it's, you know, unregulated free speech, also where you're supposed to get the truth, quote unquote, right? And inherently, because the stigma that is associated with the platform, this group, and this was done by Netcraft, they titled it "The Truth of the Matter: Scammers Targeting True Social Users." They were able to see that people tend to trust a lot more on this platform than any other platform, so they're much easier to take advantage of. And not only that, the scammers have realized this. So they said they received more than 30 scam messages within just a few hours of creating a single account. And then within a day, they had a total of 40. And that, you know, as far as the, you know, scams, like the amount of money being lost from scams on social media in general is $2.7 billion. Which is a lot of money, and a lot of these scams aren't asking for more than $250 to maybe $1,000, and they're usually tied. Like, they had some interesting ones where they basically say we're personating trusted brands as well with Spotify, Disney, Easy Park, Sky, Netflix, Google, whatever. And it was to get people to, oh, you need to re-up your subscription to this or whatever. Why you'd be getting that through True Social, you know, it just kind of shows. Maybe people using True Social as well aren't people that use a lot of technology, potentially too. So you have like this inherent trust because it's like the only place you actually do go for things. And now you're getting hit with these scams. But True Social is a growing platform. So you can imagine, I want to say in November, they saw a 355,000 daily active user, like a 3% increase from the prior month. So as that population grows, they, you know, becomes a bigger target set. So there'd be more scammers potentially trying to hit on that. And they said that the majority of the True Social, about 87%, they expect the news and information being shared there to be accurate. So that's like almost almost 90%, right? Or people just believe everything that's going to hit True Social. So from a scammer perspective, like that's ripe, right? So it goes back to, you know, how we think about what actors will prey on, right? And how they think to try to take advantage of people, same thing of taking advantage of systems, but they're going to go to where they have higher chances of success. They also understand the problem much better. So, you know, their tools and approaches will be more effective. But also shows that you got to have critical thinking everywhere you are, right? It's not just something you can just take advantage of. Like I have my favorite sources of information. And, you know, just as a reminder here, you got to still ask the questions on even your favorite sources of information. Because information is really just information until you're able to somehow validate it. And that's the thing is no one really validates things anymore. But yes, so if there are people using the True Social, you know, be cognizant of the amount of scamming that actually occurs. And I guess one of the things that was also mentioned that was interesting, because I'm not on True Social, I don't really use social media in general. But they said that when they signed up for an account, the Truth does a really good job of trying to get you to join groups, like right off the bat, making all these suggestions. I don't know if they do a questionnaire or whatever, but they said got hit with like, you know, join this group, join this group, join this group. And apparently that also helps these scammers gain information because they can see what groups you're part of. So they know what your interests potentially are to then leverage that information to social engineer you to scam you out of things, stuff like that. So yeah, it's an interesting problem that it seems, you know, culturally, you know, it's our culture and the culture around this app is really supports the scammers. And it's kind of like when you look at geopolitics, how countries talk, interact with each other to help predict cyber attacks or potential actions that could be had. Same thing when it comes to cultural things socially, when it comes to how are people going to socially engineer people. So it's just a really interesting, I didn't expect to see this. I didn't expect these types of stats, but it seems pretty rampant.
Yeah. What's interesting here, Scott, too, is with Truth Social being more of a newer platform, you know, I would imagine haven't had the time to really curate how they're going after managing these kinds of things, how they're targeting, protecting people from this, or looking at, you know, where are the holes in their algorithms, where are areas for bot control is another thing social media really kind of falls into, especially with scam stuff. It's interesting too, though, it's not mentioned in this article, but I think we, or anybody that's leveraging other social media platforms can also attest to, you know, experiences with something across those algorithms are hitting you, Facebook, Twitter, X, Instagram, anything like that. It's prominent. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that these social media apps, they're not focused on really trying to create necessarily a secure environment. They're focused on allowing people to engage with each other, right? So that just creates a ripe place for people to do these kinds of things. Something that I've been recently talking about, and we're gonna play in the realm of reckless speculation here. So just take this as my thought process and my opinion all, please. This is not any evidence or anything I have to support this, but I do think about, because of the area of profession that I'm in, I do think about what might be the next vector of leverage. I have to imagine you think about this too, Scott, when you're seeing new technologies or new things and stuff that you see or stuff that I've seen around my circles in the world, people that are leveraging TikTok or Instagram as a couple examples, they get a lot of stuff that hits their algorithm for shop stuff. So like TikTok shop, the Instagram store, things like that, where they're trying to sell people stuff. And like I'm anticipating literally with the same kind of thought processes, that's going to become a vector of slip that the social media companies, I hope they're preemptively thinking about it, but people that go into these like one click, go and buy and order this thing really fast. You know what I mean? How much scam might end up coming from that? It's just a loose thought, but it's a rampant area for these types of engagements. And I don't think these companies will ever really be able to control this because these platforms are about people engaging with people. So you're always going to be ripe here. So critical thinking is important here.
you mentioned something that kind of made my brain go off on like, oh, that's interesting. I mean, all the platforms try to allow free speech in some way. I mean, that's kind of like the American or U.S. ideal, right? You can say what you want and there's no repercussions for it. And how do we protect that? I mean, there are repercussions because it's not really as free as like there's certain things you just can't do. And, you know, but with not going into the weeds in that, what's interesting is in a platform like this where you're like, hey, we're going to protect everyone's free speech, you also remove all the protections to the people, right, as well. So you kind of can't have a really well-protected environment where you don't have to worry about scammers and random people to come at you, because the platform is really just built not built that way, right? The more you want to protect free speech in these kind of public forums where anyone in the world can talk to you, there's a risk associated with that. It's much different when you do free speech on the streets, right? Where the only people that can talk to you, you can see face to face for one. So you can already do your own assessment, but two, you know, your environment and you're not going to be like bombarded by people from across the world, right? You know, it's just, so it's an interesting paradigm, right? Like how do you support free speech and protect people at the same time? Like that's a tough one with these platforms specifically, right?
Yeah. And I think with the way we're going technology wise, especially when it comes to social media platforms, the AI portion of impact that it can have on these types
of things, because now it's not people anymore. It could be
scary. Right, but they're very convincing, right? So you have to, you said, if you're face-to-face, you can kind of naturally do an assessment of your environment. On these platforms, it's a lot easier to engage with people because there's that barrier of comfort that where you're not fully exposing yourself. So you're more willing to engage with somebody or something that's engaging with you, but you're still doing some checks. I think most people do some checks, especially if somebody tries to engage with them that they don't know. So they'll do some relative checks, look at a profile, look at previous messages they might send.
People are really good about not giving up information initially, but it doesn't prevent the conversation, right?
Correct. And the conversation would lead to that, right?
Right.
My hope is that a lot of these platforms really, like, this is my personal thought on this, is I really hope that they can find more improved ways to manage bot activity, especially with the emergence of AI and how that can be leveraged in that activity to act more like humans versus just, you know, bot posting or, you know, agenda pushing or soft scams, right? But yeah, this is something that I think isn't directly highly technical, but so worth talking about, especially in our day and age. People from no matter the profession you're in, you're leveraging social media in one way or another. Almost everybody is in some way. So definitely things to put in your noggin and spin on.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool. I think that kind of summarizes that pretty well. So a couple things I want to mention before we cut out of here is we do have our live podcast happening January 30th from 12 to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it's going to be a fun one because we're going to be really talking about a conversation a lot of people ask questions about is, you know, the ties between threat intel and threat hunting and what the appropriate threat intel looks like that it helps consistently aid to threat hunting and that relationship, what's the good, what's the bad, you know, and what is it all about. And then we also have our first level 2 threat hunting workshop. That'd be February 12th from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, hunting for initial access. And the level 2 really just means it's a more richer experience, you know, instead of just scratching just the surface, we're going to go show things a little differently, a little deeper. So it should be really fascinating and a good one, right? So I think wherever we wanted to go based on all the feedback too. So definitely check that out. But with that, I just want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast today. Looking forward to syncing up next week. And that will close out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of January 22nd, 2025.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.